This is the first day of this December 2013 four-day session. And I'm going to go to one of my favorite Sesshin Taisho texts, which is a book called Zen Essence, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. This is a collection of short teachings, short passages by maybe a dozen or so of some great Chinese masters, beginning with the great Ma Zu, whose Japanese name is Basso. For each one of these guys, there is a very little bit of biographical information in the back, in the afterword of the book. I'll read from the translator's little bit here. Ma Zu's lifetime spanned nearly the entire 8th century. Most of what is known about him is to be found in the records of his interactions with other people, recounting tales of sudden awakenings said to have been provoked by his words and acts. Ma Zu had 139 enlightened disciples, 84 of whom became public teachers. His spiritual descendants created a major impact over the next few hundred years. So he ranks right up there with the greatest of them all. He's with the sixth patriarch. Even Bodhidharma, I'd say, but he's the earliest of the masters whose teachings are in this collection. So it begins. These are his words, of course. The way does not require cultivation. Just don't pollute it. What is pollution? As long as you have a fluctuating mind fabricating artificialities and contrivances, all of this is pollution. Let's stop and comment on this. The way, the Tao, the Dharma, it's all the same, does not require cultivation. Cultivation is just a nice, rich word for practice. The way does not require practice. Just don't pollute it. So, of course, this is the fundamental teaching in Zen, which is from the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. As long as you have a fluctuating mind. Well, fluctuating, for example, in reacting to the conditions, the cold, the dark, reacting to the temporary condition of the mind, one's concentration at any given time. That's what causes us to, that is the fluctuation, the reacting to these different states. Fabricating artificialities, well, this would be thoughts of one kind or another. Analyzing the way things are, judging the way one's mind is at any given time, classifying, categorizing, evaluating, These are all artificialities, pollution, as the translator has it. He's really saying what Sun Zan, one of his descendants, said at the beginning of Affirming Faith and Mind: the great way is not difficult, just avoid picking and choosing. There are the artificialities and contrivances. And then Mazu: if you want to understand the way directly, normal mind is the way. Another translation of that is ordinary mind is the way. What is that? Well, it is the mind, the functioning of the mind without artificialities, without the judging and evaluating and analyzing, categorizing, classifying, and so forth. Just open, aware, direct experience, not thoughts about the experience. Zhao Zhou, known in Japan as Joshu, when Joshu went to Nanshan, and asked, "What is the way?" Nansen said, "Ordinary mind is the way." Joshu said, "Well, then how do I get onto this? How do I get to this ordinary mind?" He said, "The more you try to get onto it, the more it eludes you." "Well, if I don't try, then how do I find the way? How do I know?" And Nanshuan said, "It's not about knowing or not knowing. This is the profound teaching, just that. It's so profound, it's hard to grasp, but the simplicity of it. It's not really a matter of doing anything, of creating an effect, or tinkering with the mind, or getting the mind to do something that is not its natural state. It's just a matter of refraining from dwelling in thoughts." The nice thing about the word normal, the translation normal rather than ordinary, is it suggests that to use our minds in the way we usually do, through these artificialities and contrivances, is abnormal. It's average, maybe. It's the way the average person uses her or his mind, but it is kind of abnormal. Most people use their minds, misuse their minds. And then he kind of repeats, "What I mean by the normal mind is the mind without artificiality, without subjective judgments, without grasping or rejection." That is, without grasping at what we want and rejecting what we don't want. These are the twin devils of the mind, continually trying to arrange our lives according to what we want, our desires, and which implies avoiding what we don't like, our aversions. Desire and aversion, these are the tormentors of the mind. And then the next little entry, Madzu says, the founders of Zen said that one's own essence is inherently complete. Just don't linger over good or bad things. That is called practice of the way. To grasp the good and reject the bad, to contemplate emptiness, is all in the province of contrivance. And if you go on seeking externals, you get further and further estranged. For him to encourage us not to contemplate emptiness really means not to get caught in the idea of emptiness. Just end the mental objectivization of the world. A single thought of the wandering mind is the root of birth and death in the world. Just don't have a single thought and you'll get rid of the root of birth and death. Or we could say, at least don't cling to a single thought. Thoughts arise in the mind, unbidden, but we do have the choice of getting involved with them or not getting involved with them. Another great master, Fuketsu, said, if a single particle of dust is raised, the nation is established. If no particle of dust is raised, the nation perishes. This is our power, the power of the mind. We create the world moment by moment. Many people, I think, have had the experience of waking up, and in your first 1 second or 2 seconds or 3 seconds of awareness, still lying in bed, your head is on the pillow, and this is not common, I don't think, but it happens every once in a while with people where for those first 2 seconds, there's nothing other than just awareness. There's no thought of self. There's no thought of the world. It's very difficult to describe this. It's an extraordinary, fleeting state. And then after those 1 or 2 or 3 seconds, then, oh yes, I am. Oh yes, I'm in bed. Oh yes, this is my room. There. With that thought, the whole world is created. And in that mental objectivization, there's a world there, apart from me here, is the root of birth and death. He goes on, human delusions of time immemorial, deceit, pride, deviousness, and conceit have conglomerated into one body. That is why the sutras say that this body is just made of elements and its appearance and disappearance is just that of elements, which have no identity. This body is made of elements. Elements here, we could understand as the skandhas. At the beginning of the Prajnaparamita that we chant every day, we refer to the five skandhas. The bodhisattva saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. These are said to be the constituents, the basic constituents of individual existence. So there's form. That's this. Feeling or sensation is the second one. Thought. Choice or intention is the fourth. And then consciousness itself. Form here is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. They're all empty, without any substance to them. They come together they congeal in a certain pattern, and this we call the self. And then when they break apart, this is the disappearance of the self. But there is no fundamental entity that is permanent. He's also here, in this first sentence, he's really talking about karma. I gave a teisho on karma recently outside of Sesshin. Human delusions of time immemorial. Deceit, pride, deviousness, conceit have conglomerated into one body. We are reborn in accordance with our karma, but it always means that there is something to be worked out still. He continues, when successive thoughts do not await one another and each thought dies peacefully away, this is called absorption in the oceanic reflection. Each thought dies peacefully away without our getting involved in it. It's like snowflakes. These little light snowflakes that move through the mind and have nothing to them. They fall or seem to, and that's it. They last a longer or shorter time on the ground, and that's it. And then one last one from Madzu here. Delusion means you are not aware of your own fundamental mind. Enlightenment means you realize your own fundamental essence. So there is, again, this is just fundamental Zen teaching, not just Zen teaching, Buddhist teaching. We tend to divide the world into, let's say, the enlightened and the unenlightened, to delusion and enlightenment. Here, Madzu is reminding us delusion just means you're not aware of your own fundamental mind. We're all equally enlightened, but if we're not aware of it, we haven't awakened to it, well, then we can call that delusion. He continues, if you understand mind and objects, then false conceptions do not arise. When false conceptions do not arise, this is acceptance of the beginninglessness of things. You have always had it, and you have it now. You have always had it, and you have it now. Now here's another big name among Chinese masters, Lin Qi, known in Japan as Rinzai. Let's just see if there's anything here in these brief bios. Now we're into the 9th century with Lin Qi. I'm going to skip this. It's just the translators talking about his kind of teaching. Here we'll get to it, the thing itself, his teaching directly. He says, people who study the Dharma should seek real, true perception and understanding for now. If you attain real, true perception and understanding, birth and death don't affect you. You are free to go or stay. You need not seek wonders, for wonders come of themselves. Of course, he's talking about awakening, Kensho, Satori, seeing things as they are. That's what he means, to seek real, true perception. That's what the word Kensho means, seeing things as they are. Not through the prism of dualism, self and other, us and them, but cleanly, directly, this statement, you need not seek wonders, it's very common, especially for people in spiritual practice, to be looking for something wonderful. But we don't need to seek any such thing. We are just absorbed in our practice and we can refrain from dwelling in thoughts, then wonders will come of themselves. The world becomes wonderful, full of wonders. This is the mind that is beyond thought. Everything comes alive, everything becomes more vivid and almost surprising. What a remarkable, wonderful state. Everything is fresh. It's the opposite of jaded. We see so many people as they become older, becoming jaded, cynical. It's the opposite of the mind of one who is truly practicing Zen. Here again, Lin Qi, what I point out to you is only that you shouldn't allow yourselves to be confused by others. Act when you need to, without hesitation or doubt. People today can't do this. What is their affliction? Their affliction is in their lack of self-confidence. Now here's I would take issue with this translation here. The way other, or at least one other source has this is, he asks, what is it that ails you? Lack of faith in yourself is what ails you. Lack of faith in yourself. It's quite different from lack of self-confidence. Self-confidence is self-centered. It revolves around the self. You can, through various means, through good genes or good upbringing or courses in business and other things, we can become self-confident, but it's still rooted in the sense of self, the I. I'm confident in my abilities and my abilities to make things happen, my abilities to get things done and so forth. But faith in yourself is an entirely different thing. It's faith in what is beyond the self, in a way. Faith in this true self that is no self. That's where true faith leads us. A true self that is no self. Not just an expanded, aggrandized sense of self, of one's personal power. That has its value, of course. It's a big improvement over feeling low self-esteem. But faith in yourself really is something of a different order entirely. And then he continues, if you do not spontaneously trust yourself sufficiently, you will be in a frantic state, pursuing all sorts of objects and being changed by those objects, unable to be independent. Well, of course, he's talking about how we get caught up in the daily round of things and reacting to things, reacting to people, reacting to circumstances, reacting to conditions. This is not a state of freedom. Pursuing what we want, trying to avoid what we don't want, grasping at people we want, avoiding people we don't want. This is not independence, true independence. And here, now next, Lin Chi goes to one of the favorite topics of the Masters. And he says, there is no stability in the world. It is like a house on fire. This is not a place where you can stay for a long time. The murderous demon of impermanence is instantaneous, and it does not choose between the upper and lower classes or between the old and the young. If you want to be no different from the Buddhas and Zen masters, just don't seek externally. This is what we learn through Zen practice, is to balance our use of our centrifugal activity of the mind, to balance that with centripetal, gathering in. The ordinary person, all of us certainly before practice, we scatter our attention. The mind is always lurching at things and people and has no real center to it. It's not that we don't need to attend to things and people at times, but practice opens up this inner world. I don't even want to call it inner, but less attachment to people and things. And that balances the way we normally or heretofore had scattered our attention. He continues in here another entry. Zen students today are totally unaware of truth. They are like foraging goats that pick up whatever they bump into. They do not distinguish between the servant and the master or between the guest and the host. These are ancient metaphors for that which is essential to us, our essential nature, and that which is not, that which comes and goes, which means our defilements as well. The Buddha famously said, "This mind is bright and self-luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements." So the essential nature, the original nature, the true nature of the self is bright and self-luminous. And then it does, however, it has this greed, anger, and delusion, and other millions of other defilements that can inhabit the mind temporarily, but which are not essential to it. Those who really leave attachments must master real, true perception to distinguish the enlightened from the obsessed, the genuine from the artificial, the unregenerate from the sage. In other words, to discern the true from the false. The true just being that which we can't lose. That's the true. We can't lose it because we never acquired it. It's not in the realm of acquisition or loss. It is just who we are. We couldn't lose it if we tried, this self nature. Everything else we want to lose. Everything that is not essential to us. Another bit of a different topic. Because you grasp labels and slogans, you are hindered by those labels and slogans, both those used in ordinary life and those considered sacred. Thus they obstruct your perception of truth and you cannot understand clearly. So, any kinds of labels and slogans, starting with Zen, being a Zen practitioner, it's fair enough if someone is asking what kind of meditation you do to say that. But if we identify with being a Zen person, then we are caught. We're limited by that ego identity. And the same with everything else. I'm a Buddhist. No true Buddhist would want to carry around the idea of being a Buddhist. Or a vegetarian. Or a liberal, or a conservative, or a vegan, or any of the other dozens or scores of ways that we cling to self-identity. He's really talking about what the texts often refer to as attachment to name and form. Elsewhere, Lynchy also said, to speak of a thing misses the mark. How we get snared in labels about ourselves and others, get caught in words. Here's the opposite. If you want to be free, he says, get to know your true self. It has no form, no appearance, no root, no basis, no abode, but is lively and buoyant. It responds with versatile facility, but its function cannot be located. Therefore, when you look for it, you become further from it. When you seek it, you turn away from it all the more. talking also about mu here. No form, no appearance, no root, no basis, no abode, lively and buoyant. Its function cannot be located. He continues, just put thoughts to rest and don't seek outwardly anymore. When things come up, then give them your attention. Just trust what is functional in you at present, and you have nothing to be concerned about. In other words, just responding naturally to conditions, responding to circumstances, responding to people. It's a hugely important word in Zen practice, responsiveness. We can't be fully responsive if we're caught in our thoughts. You can see someone of long training, if they've really had any kind of gotten very far in practice at all, then they're always ready to spring into a response, into action, in a situation that calls for action. Just a little thing, opening a door. Someone's coming with their arms full. If you're standing there, people who are or whose minds are clogged with thoughts will often not see what's needed. The door needs to be opened for that person. There are millions of examples like this. We get opportunities all the time to respond to what is needed in our daily lives, in the most mundane ways. But none of it is mundane if our mind is empty and we're ready to respond. That's practice. Practice isn't just sitting in a certain posture. It's being alert and aware and responsive. We get practice with this in just when removing and putting the dividers back several times a day. It doesn't have to be some kind of a explosive kind of response. Or overly energetic response is just a natural amount of energy that's called for in any situation. It can be very light and graceful. We don't have to explode out of a state of stillness. And now Lin Chi takes aim at those who are attached to sitting as the only way to practice Zen. He says, there are blind baldies who, after they have eaten their fill, do zazen and practice meditation, arresting thoughts leaking out to prevent them from arising, shunning clamor and seeking quiet. This is a deviated form of Zen. Can take years and years of Zen practice to really understand in the clearest way that sitting is just a tiny aspect of Zen practice. It's an important, extremely important aspect of Zen practice, but its practice is something that we must learn to continue in all of our activities. Another Chinese master, Yong Chia, Put it this way, those who cling to vacancy, neglecting the world of things, escape drowning but leap into the fire. It's still a way of dividing the world into sitting, good, quiet, good, but everything else to be avoided. In Sesshin, we structure the schedule and the conditions in order, with a lot of silence and sitting, because it's the easiest way to bring the mind to get free of thoughts. But we can't ever get attached to these very unusual conditions of silence and sitting 10 or more hours a day. And now he, Rinchi, takes up the matter of extraordinary powers, mental powers. He's interpreting what you find sometimes in the text, reference to the six supernormal faculties of the enlightened, or the six supernormal powers, and I don't even know what they are. It doesn't matter. It's not really Zen, the real essence of Zen. And this is what he says: the six supernormal faculties of the enlightened are the ability to enter the realm of form without being confused by form, to enter the realm of sound without being confused by sound, to enter the realm of scent without being confused by scent, to enter the realm of flavor without being confused by flavor, to enter the realm of feeling without being confused by feeling, to enter the realm of phenomena without being confused by phenomena. Confused by would mean getting caught in, getting attached to the form, the sight, the sound, the smell, the taste, and so forth, the thought. These are the six senses. He just ran through what are called the six senses, the five ordinary senses, and then the sense, what's considered in Buddhism, of thought or thinking. We all partake of this sense world. Of course, there is no other world. There's no world without senses, without sights and sounds and thoughts. That's the world we live in. We have to manage. We have to negotiate this world of the six senses that includes thoughts, but just not get caught in them, not cling to any of the senses, including the said thoughts. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.